The popular demand for democratic rule in Pakistan has encouraged people who believe that better representation in government will lead to policies more responsive to the needs of ordinary people. At the same time, democracy has not stopped the persistence of mindsets, cultures, and structures that stall policymaking to improve livelihoods and grant justice. So while democracy is here, it's fragile. If the system can't deliver, it may be at risk of succumbing to autocratic rule. After all, some people see the current situation as an exception to an otherwise autocratic norm. So what will it take for Pakistan's democracy to survive? Welcome to Talking Ideas, the podcast for discussion on Pakistan's economic and human development produced by the Institute of Development and Economic Alternatives. I'm Shahryar Nabi. For this episode, I Skyped with Raza Rumi, a scholar in residence at Ithaca College and visiting faculty at the Cornell Institute for Public Affairs. He recently published a book titled Fractious Path, which is a collection of his writings on Pakistan during its democratic transition from 2008 to 2013. He gave his thoughts on the factors pointing both to democracy's weakness and durability, how to get the youth better engaged in democracy, and, in his view, why democracy is the best system of governance for Pakistan.
Given the diversity of Pakistan and its federal nature and its ethnic complexity, a democratic framework is what suits most of Pakistani population.
There's been a lot of support for democracy within Pakistan, according to a lot of public opinion polling that's been done. But you still see, you know, a significant amount of people don't necessarily feel that way and might be open to authoritarian rule as well. So what do you think in terms of conduciveness to, you know, economic and human development? What do you think is the case for democracy as sort of the best system to foster, you know, positive trends in Pakistan?
Certainly, the idea of democracy, not just in Pakistan, but I mean globally, is a contested one, as we see what is happening with world's advanced democracies, where fascism is sort of making a comeback in some way. But Pakistan's history is very interesting, because while there is always clamoring for this, you know, one-man rule and a strong autocratic government that can fix every problem of the country, there always has been a mass kind of acceptance of the idea of representative rule. So this is why, you know, I forget the name of the scholar who wrote this very interesting paper. I think it was in the 80s or the 90s, where it said that Pakistan swings between autocratic reality and the democratic ideal. Our cultural environment is authoritarian, whether it's the family or it's the school or it's the sort of notion of history that we propagated, where the past authoritarian governments or regimes or monarchies are valued and cherished as the kind of best models of governance. But Pakistanis have always defied that. You know, in the 1960s, there was a huge popular movement against Ayub Khan, which then gave way to 1970 elections. And then there was a reaction to Mr. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto's civilian authoritarianism in the late 70s. And then we saw in the 1980s again, there were two major movements for restoration of democracy under General Ziaul-Haq, and the most recent one, the 2007-2008 lawyers movement, which returned democracy. So it is a curious case. But I think one important point here is that given the diversity of Pakistan and its federal nature and its ethnic complexity, a democratic framework is what suits most of Pakistani population. You see, the voices that argue for an authoritarian structure of governance or return to one-man rule, if you notice very carefully, these are the kind of voices who are, I don't think, in the majority. Yes, they have extraordinary influence. You know, if you look at Pakistan's TV anchors, some of them openly invite the army chief to take over or do something or fix this politician or that political party. As you mentioned, if you look at the polls, you know, whatever the veracity, that's open to debate. Mm-hmm. But you see that majority of Pakistanis do prefer a representative framework for governance.
What sort of markers of progress do you think are currently present in Pakistan that suggest democracy could survive?
Whatever I have been writing is, sort of speculative, but if you actually carefully look at the trajectory in the last almost a decade, three things become very clear. First is that direct military rule is not very popular or is not a viable option in today's Pakistan. I mean, and partly that is due to the fact that Pakistan is a far more urbanized country than it was, say, in the 60s or the 70s or even 80s. The lawyers movement, it was largely an urban movement, and it did even alarm the military junta that direct military rule was not going to be acceptable anymore. The kind of beating that the military image took under Musharraf, by the end of 2007, there were reports that a lot of military officers were asked not to wear the uniform while they go out of their mess or cantonment areas, because there was this whole, the terrorists were also targeting the military. And so it became a pretty tough climate for the army to enjoy that kind of untrammeled, unquestioned power that they had. And we have seen more evidence of that. So, for example, in 2014, there were protests in the country against the current prime minister, and the military did get involved in that process. Sections of military were actually reportedly engineering those protests. But that whole six-month-long political agitation did not result in a coup. And whatever we are told from the mainstream media reporting is that the army chief, who's just left his office, actually refused to intervene and refused to take over. Yes, it sounds a bit drastic, but the reduced possibility of a coup d'etat by itself is a sign of success, in my view, problematic as it may sound. I think the second important indicator, again, has to do with Pakistan's expanded media industry since the deregulation of early 2000s, you know, ironically carried out under General Musharraf, which also became his own nemesis. So, you know, with such an expanded media scape, particularly with dozens of news channels and the rise of new media in Pakistan's urban centers, also kind of makes it very difficult for the military to directly take over and also enjoy power without being questioned. And the third indicator, I think, would be the 18th Amendment, which was a rare moment of political consensus mm-hmm. across the all political parties. Even now, there is a consensus. Even Mr. Imran Khan, who makes wild statements asking for military intervention, at the same time corrects himself and says, well, I don't want a coup. And, you know, this kind of fragile but emerging consensus is also a rare, because in the past, military has always been able to intervene or derail democracy or back up the system with the help of civilian forces. So it does find itself kind of constrained. But that's one side. I think the other important thing to remember here is that the democratic system is far from perfect. And since 2014, again, the military has found another way of exercising its power, which is from the sort of back channel, or not being in the driving seat. So their appropriation of certain key policies, such as the security and the foreign policies, which happened under the former army chief, General Rahi Jamil Sharif is an indicator that, yes, their influence has dwindled, but it is far from being over. They still are a very important player. But I think this is all a sign of evolution, and it would take another decade of democratic rule and repeated elections and improvement of the electoral processes and filters that would lead us to a more robust form of a democratic system.
Let's go to the negatives. What are the signs that you think threaten Pakistan's democracy?
The key issue here is that if people or the constituents of this democratic system, if they don't feel that they are being served under this system, or their basic needs are being met or not, or public services are being delivered or not, do they have enough voice or stake in the way governance is exercised at the provincial or federal levels, until then, the faith in democracy would not strengthen. And I think the dysfunctional local government system is one important area where Pakistan's political parties have actually failed people who elect them. Because until people are not involved at the local level, at the tehsil level, at the district level, at the union council level, in day-to-day affairs, particularly when it comes to public services such as health, education, etc., people's confidence in the democratic order would not increase as much. I think secondly is that Pakistan's political parties, while they have altered the constitution by, enacting so many amendments, but the way the political parties are organized and they function also leaves much to be desired. You know, there is virtually no political party reform or no agenda on that front. As we can see, most of parties are dynastic in nature. They are run by, or they are being run by one man like Imran Khan's party, and a group of powerful, rich people who side with either the dynast or the one man, and it's a very narrow base for decision making or setting the political party's agenda. So I think that sort of internal party reform is much required, and there are increasingly voices asking for that within political parties as well. I mean, the PTI, for example, tried to hold internal elections recently. The ruling party also held a kind of farcical electoral exercise, which was pretty fixed in a way. But I think that is what they really have to do, is that they have to build cadres of these parties. They have to ensure that these cadres are elected and that their voters and their support base is actually involved in the way political parties are structured. Take, for example, the fact that none of the political parties, I mean, I would say maybe except the MQM, that too has its own problems. None of them have proper structures to engage the youth in the country. I mean, all the time we hear about youth and how important they are, and they are 60% or 70% of the population. But if you actually closely look at the mainstream political parties' structures, there are no efforts or no proper vehicles to engage with the young voters and articulate their concerns, their views into the political party manifesto building or even its broader agenda. And then finally, I think the other issue is that we do also need to have clear campaign finance or party finance structures or rule-based structures. Because at the moment, it's all very opaque. Who funds a political party? How are these funds channeled? For what purpose? I mean, there is absolutely no transparency. We absolutely have no idea as to how it all happens. And these are the kind of areas which will have to be, I mean, again, the parliament has an important role, and then institutions like the election commission, which would need strengthening over time to at least take the country towards this direction. So this perception, credibility, and the way political parties function themselves, and at the end of the day, the results of a democratic order, particularly when they are translated into vital public services and entitlements at the local level, such as security, public safety, or social services. Until they are not realized, until they are not visible, I think people's faith in democracy would remain shaky at its best.
If democracy is sustained, do you think it would put Pakistan in a better position to adopt socially liberal policies that focus on securing rights of minority ethnic and religious groups and women? Or could democracy also favor social conservatism?
I think it could do both. I mean, we have the unfortunate aspects of our history. So, for example, in 1970s, when ostensibly a left-leaning socialist democratic government was in power, they actually, formally and constitutionally started the act of persecuting a minority group, Ahmadis. I mean, Pakistan has a rare distinction of having a parliament which feels comfortable in deciding who's a Muslim and who's not a Muslim. So we have that very unfortunate legacy. This can go either way. And again, it has to do with the fact how powerful our democratic institutions and constitutional bodies are, whether the courts and even other political parties. Because one of the problems in Bhutto's time of the 1970s was that the opposition was very weak. And it was almost always at the receiving end of Mr. Bhutto's autocratic tendencies. So there was little contribution that they could do. But again, I mean, I'm not that pessimistic, because if you see the current government, which is in power, and this is a party which was historically right-wing, and it has moved a bit to the center. And so some of the interesting reformist changes that are taking place are actually being led by the Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, whether it has to do with the minority rights, such as the Hindus Marriage Act, and there's now Assembly has passed a bill against forced conversions. At the same time, they have also enacted a legislation against honor killings. So there are some good signs that with a more inclusive and representative government, you do get better social policy outcomes. And in particular, we have a whole legacy of the 1970s and 1980s to dismantle and undo, where sort of Islamist agenda of the state and its jihad policy and their inconvenient marriage has transformed so many laws and so many structures within the country. So I think democracy is the only perhaps way that we would be able to achieve that incrementally and undo that legacy of the past. So coming back to your question, yes, I think, I mean, also look at, for example, the Benazir Income Support Program, which I'm, if I'm not mistaken, is world's largest cash transfer program of its kind, and it was also initiated under a democratic government. Look at, for example, the Lady Health Workers Program, again initiated in Benazir Bhutto's first government in, I think, 1989. And that by itself is a success story, which we rarely talk about, and in fact, our bureaucracies, whether they are at the federal or the provincial levels, try their best to undo these socially progressive institutions and programs where these lady health workers are not paid in time for months. Their salaries are abysmal. So they ultimately have to protest for weeks and months to get their basic salaries. But look at the tremendous work that they've done. I mean, during my field work in various parts of Pakistan, I mean, I was actually blown off by the services they render at the grassroots level. And, not just with the health anymore, their agenda has increased, and they have turned out to be far better agents of policy implementation than the formal, rigid, conservative bureaucratic structures we have. So these two programs I'm citing, because they were kind of, I mean, cynics also call them extension of patronage politics. And yes, patronage is not going to go away that soon, whether we like it or not. But these two programs also indicate that it is Pakistan's political parties and democratic governments that have actually placed socially progressive pro-women agenda into development policy.
Going to that point on patronage, basically one major problem, as you touched on, is that, you do have these programs, but they get sucked into existing systems of patronage. And that speaks to the broader problem of political interference in institutions that, even if they have policies that seem good on the surface of them, they're not insulated from all the political interference that can end up undermining whatever good intention that policy had. Given this sort of climate, given this setting, what do you think are sort of the solutions we need, both on, a technical level, in terms of policy design, but also politically, in terms of having a system where that's insulated from this political interference?
In a democratic system, you know, it is very difficult to quote unquote insulate such programs or even policy design from political imperatives, because they go hand in hand, and it'll be just another denial of the fact that politics drives policy. That's going to stay. I mean, it's not going anywhere. Where we can make improvements is the quality of bureaucracy, in particular the quality of civil service. And by that I just don't mean the quote unquote superior civil services that are recruited each year through the competitive examination, but in terms of how hiring is done at the service delivery level, whether these are the teachers or health workers or paramedics or the land revenue agents such as patwaris, etc., and how they are managed, what are they paid, and whom are they accountable to. I think those are areas where we really have to work very, very hard to kind of set up new workable systems of accountability, because whatever is there already is obviously not functioning. I mean, it has collapsed. So, and that particular accountability, again, is linked to electoral or democratic accountability, particularly at the local levels. And for that, we just cannot bypass local government system. And that is a major paradox that Pakistan's political parties are very eager to, launch movements and return into power and push the military out of the tent. But when it comes to passing on power or transferring power at the local level, they don't want to share their pool of patronage or, the pie. They all want to hog it. But, that is something that they would need to reconsider. And this is why we need more robust public debates, particularly in Pakistan's media, where these issues are not taken up. So, for example, what perhaps needs to be done is that the accountability systems within the bureaucratic system and external accountability through public channels such as the civil society groups, the civic association at the local level, the media, and other instruments. I mean, they really have to now come into play. And if you have more scrutiny of this so-called idea of corruption, which I feel is also overblown in the political discourse, because whenever we talk of corruption, we talk of Panama scandal or the military generals getting land or bureaucrats getting plots. But the reality is that is just a tip of the iceberg. The menace of malfeasance, corruption, or leakages, or whatever you want to call it, is actually, again, at that very local level. Yeah. It is a person who goes into a police station to file a complaint, a person who wants a copy of his land deed from a patwari, or somebody who needs an injection from a local health facility, or a primary school teacher whose salary is actually forcibly deducted by the accountant to contribute to the pool of graft shared by the top education officials. That is where we really have to focus, because that kind of gets sidelined, you know, this in this larger civil military power and the media playing that up as the flavor of the day. And that will come through these internal and external accountability systems. But let me also add the other major missing or a major problem here, which has also been the extremely weak role of legislature. So while we have, you know, now two terms of democratic governments, unfortunately, the parliament had to exercise their functions of holding the executive accountable the way they have to, even according to our rules and procedures. So I remember that in 2012, I was part of an evaluation looking at the parliamentary committees, how they function. I visited the Punjab Assembly, I think it was 2012 or maybe 2013, early 2013. And, you know, on paper, they have all these committees where a parliamentary secretary is appointed and he or she has some perks and privileges, etc. But a lot of those committees had never met. For example, the education committee. I asked them how many meetings have they had. And I was shocked to find out that, you know, they barely met in all those years, you know, whether it was the education committee or other important committees. And that is where, again, the role of political parties, the role of the civil society is so important, because why are these committees not meeting, and why are they not taking up the plethora of complaints and issues that come their way? And their deliberations can also be a great mechanism to kind of, I wouldn't use the word insulate, but to refine the policy process in Pakistan. The other set of institutions which have a very important role, again, is the federal and the provincial ombudsman offices. They are, again, weak in their capacities. They don't have enforcement power. And that, you know, those offices can again play a very important role in both grievance redress and also keeping independent statutory checks on the key policy ministries or departments in the, you know, at the subnational levels. And I remember that in 2002, local government ordinance that was created under Musharraf's regime, they even had an idea of setting up district ombudsman. And, you know, so there was a lot of resistance to that, you know, because everybody, even the district sessions judge, I believe, were not in favor of that. But, you know, that is an idea that we need to revisit, because having these independent offices that can actually hold the executive functions, and because remember that policy is not always national or made at the top level. I mean, policy also is made at the provincial level, at the district level. The district coordination officers, in their work, also create local policies, you know, almost on a daily basis. And sometimes they get implemented, sometimes they are echoing what the local political bosses want. So we need to have this strengthened institutional architecture at various levels of governance that both encourages accountability, includes some accountability processes, mm-hmm. and at the same time involves the political actors in a more positive and concrete way than just patronage. But, you know, coming back to your original first part of your question, I don't think that the patronage would just disappear. Would require institutional strengthening.
For democracy to survive in the long term, you have to have the young generation, you know, interested in democracy, wanting to carry out the democratic project. So what ways do you think would be best to instill a sense of democracy into the youth?
The key issue here is that our public narratives, you know, which are kind of rooted in the education textbooks that we use, media narratives that influence and shape public opinion, particularly in the vernacular press and other modes of popular culture, they instill this whole anti-democracy framework among the younger people, particularly children. So for years, even the kind of textbooks that I studied in school glorified the military rulers such as General Ayub Khan, General Yahya Khan, and even General Zia. And, you know, we did not, I mean, until I had the chance to, you know, study under the A-level system, I did not even know what was the role of General Yahya Khan in the breakup of Pakistan. So many of these stories are actually hidden from young people, and that is a major challenge of democracy building in Pakistan, that we have to redo the textbooks in the country. And sadly, these efforts have not really gone too far, because what we have seen are actually worsening of the existing narratives in provinces like Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, where the Jamaat-e-Islami is a coalition partner and they have actually resisted any kind of serious reform. Some efforts have been made in Sindh and in the Punjab, but you know, what we require is a major revamp of public education system. But alongside, we also have to undo this ridiculous policy of banning student unions in the universities and on campuses. You know, since General Ziaul Haq's time in the 1980s, they have been banned, and then we, you know, democracy was restored in 1988. Benazir Bhutto also spoke about them, but no effort was made. I think in 2008, 20 years later, when the PVP took power after General Musharraf, one of the first announcements by the Prime Minister was also to restore the student unions, but no effort has been made. In fact, what you have is a kind of strange narrative in the media saying, oh, the student unions are not good, they will lead to further violence, they will not enable young people to study. And that is a major problem that we have to now contend with, because what we've done with all these young people, particularly, you know, even whom we call the educated, because, I mean, nearly half of the youth, as we know, is not literate even, or 40% to 50%. So what we've done is that we've created these depoliticized young men and women who basically have very little understanding of their own history, let alone the importance of a democratic process. So this is why they kind of get swayed by the more authoritarian brands of democratic participation popularized by Imran Khan. But I mean, he's not the only one, but I mean, you know, even in other political parties with the way dynastic politics rules, etc. So there's this complete acceptance of authoritarian tendencies. And I think that has to do with both the textbooks and also the fact that there is no proper evolution of democratic culture. Mm-hmm. If you look at some of the key leaders today in various political parties, they actually emerged from the student unions. So, you know, we have truncated whole organic process of building politics from the universities or lower levels. And so I think we really have to think of these major reforms in both education sector as well as this policy of getting the student unions back. And finally, I think what is also more important is the kind of extraordinary role and influence of media, particularly the electronic media. And of course, that is a bigger challenge and a problem, because these kind of discourses also get amplified and articulated time and again on TV screens and in the opinion pieces in Urdu newspapers, where, you know, there is this whole continuous reference to the autocratic past of the Arab Empire and how that made the best solution for Pakistan.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Talking Ideas. Many thanks to Raza Rumi for coming on. Once again, Talking Ideas is produced at the Institute of Development and Economic Alternatives, or IDEAS for short, where I work as a communications coordinator. IDEAS conducts research on a wide range of topics pertaining to development in Pakistan, including education, finance, law, and governance. You can see our work at ideaspak.org. Thanks for listening.